Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Carlos Collazo, Baseball America Draft Podcast. We are back, and we've got a lot to talk about today, because as you know, if you've gone to baseballamerica.com already, we are now up to the 500. The BA 500 is live. Now, that does not mean it's locked down. You know, we've got a lot of work that'll go over the next month plus. We'll tweak, we'll update, we're updating reports, you know, now that the season's wrapped up for players and all that. But we have reached the point where we are up to the 500. We rank 500. Really, we rank about 600, 650 when it's all said and done, because we'll also include senior signs who aren't in the 500. And we'll make sure that we at least have the reports for the other players who were in the 500 and dropped out. But 500's a good number. Carlos, I was apologizing to him offline. I didn't do pretty much anything in writing up 400 to 500 guys. That was like really, I think, a Carlos and Ben Battler project as much as anything.
Yeah.
We were worried about the college, you know, the conference tournaments and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But
yeah,
go ahead.
On the amateur side, I was just going to say, I feel like late May and the entire month of June is probably our busiest single section of the calendar. There's just so much going on, and getting to 500 is always a really great milestone. It feels good to get there. But at the same time, we've got a lot of reports from the preseason that we want to get updated and finalized to really get you the most in-depth reports possible. So if you're looking ahead to the draft, or once your team drafts these players, you'll really have a really in-depth report and know these players, what they do well, what they do poorly, how they've changed and transformed. So it is a lot of time spent after this stage fine tuning our reports, and like JJ said, we will have multiple updates as we approach the draft, because it feels like the draft should be here, but we still have more than a month to go. There's going to be combine, there's going to be some summer stuff, there's going to be the NCAA postseason, which JJ and Jacob and Jeff have been getting everyone ready for at Baseball America. So it's a busy time, and let's get into whatever you want to get into, JJ.
And speaking of that, well, the other thing we're going to do today, we're going to cover like some of the big movers in the 500, but we're also today going to kind of give you a little bit of a postseason preview, because there are players who what they do in the postseason may matter, but there are players that it's going to matter a lot more than others. To, you know, example, Von Lackey doesn't have to do anything in the postseason. He's hit 410 with power while playing great defense at Georgia Tech. Okay, he's a catcher. We know what he is. If he has a great month, great. If he has a terrible month, okay. But there's other players a little bit different. We're going to get to that. But first, we're going to dive into the new 500. And so we're always trying to adjust for what we're hearing as far as players moving up, players moving down. Carlos, who is the player that kind of stands out the most as far as, okay, we had to bump that guy up, bump him up, mm-hmm. bump him up.
Yeah, when we were doing the risers and fallers piece for this update, I did feel like we had less movement in the first round and in the top 100 at this stage, which I feel good about. Hopefully we've captured a lot of the biggest movement of those players at this point. But Tyler Bell, the Kentucky shortstop, was probably the most notable up arrow player inside the first two rounds, maybe the first round range. We moved him up from early 20s, 21 to 11 right now, and I think it's just a case of a premium up the middle defensive profile who's also having a really strong offensive season. Tyler Bell was tricky for us to figure out earlier in the year because he had a shoulder injury in his first game of the season. He missed some time. He took a little bit to get back. When he came back initially, he was playing DH, but then he kind of quickly got reintegrated into this Kentucky lineup, has been one of the better performers in this Kentucky lineup, and has looked pretty good at shortstop since he's been back as well. So I think he's just done everything that teams want to see. And while he is not the toolsiest player in this draft, he's a pretty well-rounded one. He does a lot of things really well. He's shown an incredibly patient offensive approach. He is not going to expand the zone and get himself out by any means. He has a 517 OBP right now. He has a career best offensive season. He has a draft eligible sophomore, so it's not like he has multiple years of production prior to this. But I do think that, like, given Tyler Bell's tool set, teams really wanted to feel confident in the pure hitting ability and the performance, and I think he's doing that so far this year. And so we've got him in the top half of the first round at this point. I think that's where he's being really heavily scouted by teams who are making picks in the 6 to 16 range.
333, 468, 576 in SEC conference play this year, which for him, there's not a whole lot of difference between his stat line between conference play because, as you just mentioned, he kind of missed the non-conference part of the season and then, to his credit, had to kind of jump on a moving train and basically get back into the swing of things really as the conference season started in the SEC, and he didn't really have an issue with it. To follow up on that, like, we have him now. We've talked all year about how there's this kind of top tier, which I would say on the college bat side really is a two-player top tier. It's Rochelowski, it's Von Lackey.
Right.
And then there's a gap. How possible is it, do you think? When Bell moving up to 11 here, mm-hmm. has he kind of reached kind of his high watermark that he can get to? Is there room for him to move up further, or
right.
are there just a little bit of limitations to his game that probably mm-hmm. keep him from moving significantly further up this list?
I think the answer to that is probably both. I think he could move up as far as 7 in our draft board on our final update, and it wouldn't shock me. I think once you get outside of our elite top tier, which includes our top 6 prospects now, you can check out the BA 500 to see the exact order there. But I view that as the top tier in this class. I think once you get into that next group, which includes Bell, Drew Burris at Georgia Tech, Ryder Helfrich at Arkansas, Chris Hacopian at Texas A&M, I think all of these players are fairly interchangeable. And if you wanted to make the case to me that, hey, Tyler Bell is a college shortstop who checks all the boxes, gets on base, doesn't have the same hit tool risk as a Ryder Helfrich, maybe has more physical projection than a Drew Burris, can maybe do a lot more defensively for you than a Chris Hacopian can, you could argue him at the very top of that group. I really think from 7 to maybe even 30 or so, there's a lot of interchangeability of this class, which makes it a challenge, but also think gives Tyler Bell the ability to push really as high up this board as the very top of the second tier players. That's how I view it. I'm curious if you view it differently.
No, I think you're probably right. Like, I do think that as you said, you get to 7 and it's kind of going to be eye of beholder. We've said, we keep trying to signpost this. There could be someone who goes 7, 8, 9 in this draft who we have at 22, 23 on our board.
Right.
Or there could be someone who goes 22, 23 in the draft who we have 8, 9, 10 on this board. It's very much like it is very muddled, and there is extremely small amounts of separation outside of that top group. Like, so it's going to be how different teams evaluate players and what they're looking for mm-hmm. combined with, okay, there's going to be absolutely a when everyone's kind of viewed in that same range, the players willing to cut a deal are also likely to go before the guys who are like, nope, I'm sticking to my number. Right. I'm not moving on it. And that may mean that you see a guy go 10 who signs for less money than a guy who went 20, even though they're in the same. Normally, when you see that, it's more of that they're different demographics, right? Like, the guy who goes 10, who's a college pitcher, may get less money than the high school pitcher at 22
right.
because of the leverage and all. This year, it could be like where you see an outfielder go at 10 who signs for less money, college outfielder signs for less money than a college outfielder goes at 18. Mm-hmm. And it would be like, no, that's just how the two teams kind of
right.
worked the equation. But I will say, like, as much as Bell moved up, Bell was already in the first round.
Right.
There's another SEC draft prospect who 120 spot jump since our last update. So explain kind of the Taylor Robb explosion, the Ole Miss right-hander.
Yeah, Taylor Rabe, right-handed pitcher at Ole Miss. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, JJ. We said, hey, look at the college pitching demographic as the specific demographic who can jump up boards. And heading into the BA 500 update process, I felt pretty confident we were going to get Taylor Rabe into the top 3 round range. We had him in the 120 to 150-ish range, like 4 to 5 round bucket previously. I knew he was going to move up. The stuff has been tremendous. The strikeout to walk has been exceptional. And as we were putting together the list, we just continued to get really positive feedback from the industry. It was like, no, you need to go higher. You need to go higher with him. So he jumps up to, where exactly do we have him here on this board? 39, right behind Jack Riddell, who is another big up arrow riser. There's this cluster of college pitchers, Ben Blair, Jack Riddell, Taylor Rabe, who I'm not sure if they are consensus first round picks across the industry, but we've got them in a position where they're not really far off the board after that. And I think the combination of power, strike throwing, physicality that Taylor Rapp has shown this year, on top of the performance, he's been really good in SEC play, just warrants this up arrow move.
I will say, we just talked about with Tyler Bell that this is kind of like, okay, he might move up another spot or two. This is kind of a little bit of almost jumping into our second segment, which is a ways away still. But I think he is someone who, if the postseason goes really well, we may, as we said, we're going to keep updating this. Mm-hmm. It would not shock me if he climbed, if he keeps doing what he's been doing recently, which to, if someone was asking, well, what has he been doing recently? Well, he struck out 14 against Texas A&M on May 9th, and he struck out 13 with no walks. And he struck out 13 with one walk against Alabama on May 15th, which, by the way, those are not like rollover teams. Those are teams who are prominent in the postseason. If he keeps doing this,
yeah,
he has real stuff. And when you say, like, I will say his ERA has kind of not come along for the ride, but I do know that you love, and I love too,
yeah,
you know, looking at walk, basically
strikeout rate minus walk rate. That's my money stat rate. Yeah.
He's first in SEC play. He's number one of all SEC pitchers if you're looking at in conference play. And he's also number one in K rate in conference play. Yeah. He has an exceptional strikeout rate and an exceptionally low walk rate.
Yep.
While touching 100.
Yeah, I love this stat because I really just think it isolates talent and dominance really well, which is what you're looking for college pitchers. So if you look at college pitchers this year who have thrown at least 50 innings and you just sort by strikeout minus walk rate, the first five names you get are Dax Whitney, Mason Edwards, Ruger Riojas, Taylor Rabe, Logan Redman. I mean, right after that is Cole Carlone. I could keep going down the list. There's some really impressive underclass arms here. But when you pair that dominance and then you look at the actual pitch stuff and see what he's throwing, this is not a smoke and mirrors pitchability college performer. This is a guy with legitimate impact stuff. I mean, his fastball grades out tremendously well, just based almost entirely on the power. I mean, it's 96 to 99 miles per hour pretty consistently. He's got a couple of really promising secondaries to go with it. So I just think that he kind of is checking a lot of boxes, and if you wanted to put on some thresholds or markers for walk rate, I would imagine he's in a pretty elite company in that as well. Like, it almost surprised me with how good his walk rate has been this year and even historically. He's just been a dominant pitcher, and I think he's getting rewarded for that, and he'll be rewarded for that on draft day.
I would say this. Like, the reason I just kind of lay this out, he does feel like that we may be on – I'm not saying it's the same pitcher. I'm not saying he's going to go top 10 or anything like that. But there is a little bit of the Cade Horton story here again, yep, from the standpoint of guy coming off Tommy John. Like, if you said, well, why weren't you guys as high on him coming, you know, at the start of the year? You got to remember, this guy didn't throw into the sixth inning, mm-hmm, until April 12th. They ramped him up. Like, it was something where it was 2-3 innings. They were working him up. And basically, yep, kind of like we got to April and it's like, okay, now we're going to release you to just be a starting pitcher, no limitations, go for it. And right, he's just gotten better and better and better. But there's a small, like, you can look at it both ways. There's a small track record here compared to the other pitchers that he's now in this world with. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's also a guy who has projectability, who has present stuff. And right, you could say, like, there's more runway here for him to keep getting better because we just haven't seen him on the mound very much in college.
Yeah. I think teams seem less concerned when pitchers who are pitching well with real stuff don't have a lengthy track record. You mentioned Cade Horton. We see a lot of these guys who really just jump up. And if you're performing and teams think that what you're doing now and what you're showing now is representative of your true talent, it does seem like they're not as keen to penalize you as they might be for a hitter who has less track record. And I think maybe I'll just emphasize here as we close out with Rabe, the jump in his stuff year over year is significant. Like, he's almost three full ticks fastball velocity harder in 2026 than he was in 2025. And he was already sitting with average fastball velocity a year ago. It's 93.7, but now he's averaging just over 96. It's just a really impressive jump in stuff, and the performance followed.
I just kind of want to ask you with that. So we have Cade Townsend, like, so speaking of apples to apples somewhat, Ole Miss starting pitchers. We have Cade Townsend 12 spots ahead of him right now. They're now actually having had kind of, I would say, similar seasons. Like, it's funny, like, you know, I just talked about how Ray, they kind of ramped him up, but he's got 57 innings. Townsend has 59. They have basically the same number of strikeouts. Rabe's walked a few less. Is it crazy to think that we could end up seeing Rabe end up going off the board before Townsend? Or is that like that kind of like where he could work into that range? Or is that maybe a little bit hot?
Yeah, I'll be curious. I don't know that I have a great feel for that currently. Certainly, they're a lot closer today than they were a few weeks ago. Like when we were doing our last mock draft, Cade Townsend's name was coming up throughout the entire first round, and Rabe's name really wasn't mentioned. So I'd say for now, I'd probably still feel like it's more likely that Townsend goes in front. But the fact that we're having this conversation now, I think maybe speaks to the fact that they are a little bit closer. So I guess I might have a better answer for that in the coming weeks.
Okay, speaking of, these are all guys, the college guys. We're talking about the big risers in the top 100 that come to the college side first. And these are also all players who, if you're listening to this, you can watch this weekend in NCAA regionals as well. Next one up is North Carolina center fielder, which, by the way, you can just start right there and say North Carolina center fielder. Generally, you know that guy's going to go pretty well. That's pretty much like a, okay, so he's going top 2-3 rounds, right? Because that's what they do every time. But North Carolina center fielder Owen Hull, he was another big climber in this. Why is Hull climbing up boards?
Yeah, I think Hull has just done a really nice job performing in conference. He was a player who came into this season with maybe high expectations. 6'4", 215-pound outfielder, left-handed hitter with tools. He's got power. He's got speed. He's got good defensive ability. And I think just given his track record at George Mason, the question was going to be, okay, like you put up numbers there before, you've performed there before, how are you going to handle the ACC? He hit well early on, and I think in particular the conference performance numbers with Owen Hull has given teams a lot of confidence. He hit 418, 500, 648 in conference, and OPS north of 1100. And so when you look at, and I think depending on how teams come to this, Owen Hull, I think the biggest question for him is, can he get the ball in the air? His batted ball angles are probably not exactly how you'd want to draw it up. He's not able to take full advantage of the raw power that he does have. Maybe some teams think that those angles are a little bit more innate and harder to change. If you're a team who thinks you can maybe help him improve the launch angle a little bit, get the ball in the air to the pull side more, I think there's a lot of upside to be had here. And I think when we were updating this list, we really felt like he belonged in this really interesting toolsy performance college outfielding group that includes Carter Beck at Indiana State, who is a model darling, Will Gasparino at UCLA, who is the ultimate tool shed, high risk, high reward profile. And then guys like Kyle Jones at Florida as well. So he felt like he fit much more in that range for this update than where he did previously. I think he's got a really good chance to go in the second or third round.
Going to ding the ACC a little bit here. They haven't updated their stats on their site since the tournament. Come on, guys. But I will note that I can pretty much surmise from that second best batting average in conference play this year behind Jaron Avicula, who, by the way, before the ACC tournament was hitting 477 in ACC play.
Which yeah, is and absurd. I didn't realize it was that good relative to the other conference hitters. But when you think about how Jaron Avicula is viewed in his pure hitting ability and you layer on the tool set that Owen Hull has, like, it's a really exciting profile. There's a lot more to dream on in terms of impact there. So
I should say, I apologize, ACC. They've separated the tournament as postseason stats, which
I kind of agree with that, but it is ACC competition.
I mean, yeah, but okay. But what I'm saying though is, yes, so Hull hit 432 in ACC regular season play, yep, which is a number that I think will absolutely kind of, you know, that'll be one that people will be paying attention. And again, as we always say, I know that someone's hearing this and saying, why do you keep talking about batting average? But batting average for developing players is much different than the value of batting average for major league players, where on base obviously becomes more important. But batting average is pretty good proxy for your hitting ability in
100%
for draft prospects. But one more college player that we want to cover, which is, I think, one of the more fascinating stories of this. Like, when
is your guy.
When Garrett Wright signed with Tennessee, you would have expected him to be playing catcher this year. But then he had a hand injury right before the season. And it really does speak to his athleticism. And by the way, they also have in the time that, you know, so he really, the hand injury basically meant that it hurt to catch stuff, right? And Tennessee has a lot of stuff as he was working his way back. So they stuck Garrett Wright in center field. And not a whole lot of catchers could have the athleticism to be like,
right.
Not even, we're going to stick you in left field. We hope they won't hit the ball to you very much. Like, nope, you're our center fielder now. Right. And Garrett Wright's done it, which I do think really kind of adds to his value that you really demonstrate his athleticism there, didn't he?
Yeah, I think it has to, because even though I would imagine most teams are still really excited about what he could look like as a full-time catcher, the fact that you have this exit ramp that still gives you a premium position player that's going to allow whatever he does for you offensively to profile really nicely, I think has to be thrilling to teams. I mean, he's had really good performance as well. Maybe the conference numbers not quite as impressive as some of the other guys we're talking about in this range with Hull and Bell in particular. But overall, the season lies impressive. He's got 3 years now of an OPS greater than 1,000. He has some strength and power. I think with his approach, there are some low-hanging fruit there to improve him and get him to be a little bit more productive. But the athleticism and the defensive profile is really compelling here. And I think as we talk about this college catching class especially, there are a lot of just unique athletes at catcher this year. Von Lackey is obviously the headliner. Daniel Jackson turning in a historic season for a catcher with this rare power-speed combo. Add Garrett Wright to that group, and I think in general, college catching profiles are, teams want to draft catchers, and the college demographic is overwhelmingly where they go to do that. So these are profiles that tend to get pushed up boards. Even if you think you like a player as a fourth rounder, you might have to take that player in the third round just because you're not going to get a chance to grab them. There's just a scarcity element here. And I do think we've got a lot of up arrow movement on a number of catching profiles beyond Garrett Wright. I think part of that is because maybe we're just lighter on that demographic heading into this update. But I do think a lot of these guys have gone out and performed and are just super valuable to teams. So we're trying to reflect that in the update here.
Don't want to ignore the prep side, though, too, because there are also guys on the high school side who are moving up. Two guys most notably, I'll just like kick it to you there. There's a shortstop and an outfielder. Why did Dylan Bowen and Andrew Giles, and by the way, Andrew Giles spells that with a U, which, you know, I see that and I'm like, wait, Andrew, no, Andrew.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure he's going to get mistaken for Andrew Jones quite a bit, just with the GJ sound in the second part of the name. But yeah, two high school players that are new entrants onto our draft board, guys who have had really strong spring seasons. I'll just hit on those briefly now. But I think for Bowen, it's more that last summer, we got the sense the teams thought he was a really skilled player, but maybe didn't have the sort of tool set that warranted him being in this range. And the tools have jumped this spring. They're much better. He's stronger. He's turning in 65 run grade times from home to first. He has a chance to play shortstop defensively at the next level. And then Andrew Giles, he doesn't look like a typical corner outfield slugger. He's a little bit smaller than that, 5'11", 180 pounds. His swing seems more geared to line drives. It's fairly level. But I think scouts are really enamored with his hit power combination in particular. There's a lot of confidence in his traits to hit. He's shown impressive raw power to all fields for a player of his size. He's left-handed, which helps if scouts think he's going to be a corner outfielder, which there's a risk he might be. He's a solid runner. He's not a burner. So I imagine if he's a guy who gets drafted out of his Oregon commitment, he probably starts in center field and plays there as long as he can. But I think for Giles, it's mostly the hit power combo has been so impressive this spring. But yeah, two exciting toolsy prep hitters in Dylan Bowen, who's in Indiana, and then Andrew Giles in Nevada, who just want to bring people's attention to. We have them both in the sort of top six round range at this stage.
So that's a look at some of the players who rose up in the top 100 in the most recent update. But next, what we're going to do is look at some guys who could impact their draft status pretty significantly during postseason play. We'll do that right after this quick break.
Hey, this is the Mack Weldon line that resonates with me. The go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Hibernation time is over, and that means it's time for a wardrobe change. Bye-bye layers, hello shorts, and breathable clothing. Discover upgraded basics, fresh styles, and more at MackWeldon.com. Plus, get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code FOUL. Mack Weldon is effortless by design, always in style, versatile, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. You should check out the Ace Collection. That's one of the items I just got for super comfy shorts. It's clothes for every occasion. I like to keep it simple. This is for that day-to-day classic look that makes matching easy. Get moving with Mack Weldon, comfortable anywhere. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code FOUL. That's MackWeldon.com, code FOUL.
So, Carlos, we're back, and this is going to be, I think, one of the things that we'll both be paying a lot of attention to this weekend. Mm-hmm. We wanted to pick out five players who, college players, obviously, we're talking about NCAA regionals this weekend, and regionals, yep. Super regionals, Omaha. Here are five players who, how they perform, could have a bigger impact on where they go potentially than other players. Again, obviously it impacts everyone, but it impacts players differently. We'll explain in each of these cases why it could be so impactful for this player. We're going to start, though, with one of the top pitching prospects in this class. And I think this one, no matter how closely, and again, if you're at minute 25 of a draft podcast, I guess you're paying probably pretty close attention. I don't think we need to explain much why Cameron Flukey and what he does in the regional and, you know, beyond, if Coastal goes deeper, is very important. I will just start with, to kick it to you, 20.0, he was injured obviously after his first start this year, 20.2 innings so far this year. So more than anything, getting to see a healthy, dominant Cam Flukey on the mound is something that teams are still kind of really kind of waiting to see, right?
Right. So he came back from his rib strain about a month ago, and he's still working the pitch count and the volume in his games back up. He threw two innings in his first two starts. I think he's been up to four innings so far. So I think just seeing him get to closer to like midseason form, he's still not quite there yet. The stuff has been probably what you would expect with Cameron Flukey. His fastball velocity has been there, mid-90s up to 98, 99, which is typical of him. I think you maybe haven't seen the same sort of polish and execution that you were used to a year ago. The strike throwing in particular has been a little bit more, I wouldn't say bad, but rougher than what it was a year ago. And I think Cameron Flukey is a player who teams have a lot of confidence in because he has multiple seasons of high-level starter track record. He's got one of the better fastballs in the class. He has this foundation of strike throwing and command that gives teams a lot of confidence in his starter profile. But there are added health concerns now that he missed so much time. I think there are some questions about how he does it on the mound with his delivery. That's not been a problem for him execution-wise, but I do think there maybe will be more health concerns for how he does it, just given his health track record and history to this stage. So I think more than anything, having Cameron Flukey be healthy, pitch deeper into games, and just show the stuff that teams have come to expect for him is going to be really key, because I do still think that we don't have an obvious who's the next college pitcher in this class after Jackson Flora is off the board. I think that is still fairly wide open for pitchers who are competing in this NCAA tournament. There's going to be a chance for someone to come out and kind of make their mark and be that pitcher. Cameron Flukey is best positioned given the track record and the sort of prospect status he entered the year with. But I do know that there are teams picking in the middle of the first round that if he got to them, it's not like a slam dunk. Yes, they're taking him. So I think for him, it's more like it's kind of reinforcing he is who we all thought he was. And Flukey is a guy who's pitched at this stage at a very high level. He's done it before. But mostly, I think just logging more innings, throwing more pitches, getting deeper into games is going to be really important for him.
Next up is a guy we've talked about a lot this year on the draft podcast, but Alabama shortstop Justin LeBron, who, let's just start by saying, like, obviously every player having a good postseason's useful, helpful, mm-hmm. but it is a credit to LeBron's tools that he has slid in our rankings. We had him at the start of the year. We were talking about, hey, is this a guy who could battle Brock Chalowski for being the best shortstop on the board?
Yeah, we had him on our February list. We had him five. He was top five in each of our first two updates this year coming into the draft class. Now we have him at 19.
But the fact that he is still 19th says so much about him, because on performance, this is not a first-round pick. If you said that, if you were basing it on performance, LeBron is hit in conference play, which your to-do list for Justin LeBron coming into the year, we did this for all the first-round picks, was, you know, better season and show that you can hit in conference play, because conference play is kind of a proxy for the best arms. If you're an SEC player, the best arms you're going to face are going to be in conference play. And LeBron hit 229, 328, 413 in SEC play. Yep. To put that in perspective, in OPS, that was 83rd out of 113 SEC qualifiers. In batting average, that was 93rd out of 113 qualifiers. It's hard to find someone who's gone in the first round in recent years with that kind of SEC conference play stat line. Mm-hmm. However, we still expect him to be a first-round pick right now. And I would also say, with a deep run for Alabama, with a strong postseason where he kind of has a couple of games where Justin LeBron puts this team on his back.
Right.
I think that it would help kind of like kind of push some of this kind of into the background a little bit.
Yeah, I think for LeBron, it's maybe a more like narrow conversation you're going to have, because I do think the teams who are going to eliminate LeBron from consideration for their first overall pick because of his track record, those teams probably are not going to be swayed by a few hot weeks if Alabama makes a run in the tournament. But I think the teams who are still really enamored with his tools and his upside, if they have high level decision makers going in to watch him and just trying to get a better feel, and he has one of those Justin LeBron games, which he's definitely capable of having. He's capable of hammering a ball out of the park to the pull side, of making some highlight reel defensive plays, of just being a menace on the base paths. Like, I do think that at this stage, having a kind of show me performance in front of decision makers can move the needle and make the difference. And so for him, it's mostly just like, hey, you're going to be on a big stage now. You didn't have the season you wanted, but if you can showcase, like, I have these elite tools, this is why you're going to take a shot on me and flash those, I think he's got a chance to just give whoever is going to take a shot on him, which, again, it's been a challenge for us to figure that out. But there are still a number of teams that would really like to get a shot at his upside. I think performing in front of those specific evaluators could be really crucial for his draft stock.
You just laid this out with Fluky, but I think it's even more true of LeBron. I cannot think of anyone that we expect to go in the first round who has a wider range of kind of, it would not shock you if he went top 10, I think, still. Like, is that fair? Like, that there's,
yeah,
still,
I teams. Think there are a couple legitimate landing spots inside the top 10. And then if he pulled a Vahiva Aloy like last year and slipped out of the first round entirely, that wouldn't shock me either.
It's an extremely wide range. I feel like this next player also has a pretty wide range, which is Arkansas right-hander Gabe Gackel, who, again, is another guy who's kind of slid, I think, a little bit in our rankings pretty steadily through the season, in part because, I'll just kind of lay it out again, like, he hasn't really performed. He was a starter back into the pen, kind of been in a little bit of both roles. And even when he's been in the pen, there are times in the pen where he's really kind of handling a starter workload kind of coming out of the pen. But 5.4 ERA in SEC play, even more concerningly, 1.88 whip, which is, that's 50th out of 51 SEC pitching qualifiers in conference play. And then the K to BB percentage number that we talked about earlier when we were talking about Taylor Rabe and what it's done for him, 48th out of 51 SEC pitchers in conference play. So it's been a disappointing season for Gackel, but the season's not over yet, is it?
It's not. And I think when I think of the Cade Horton, the Gage Woods of the world, I think of Gabe Gackel, because I do think he has just elite pure stuff. I continue to really like him despite the performance this year, despite the fact that he's having the worst strikeout to walk rate of his career this season. He faces reliever concerns, and because of all these questions and the performance, he's very split campy in the range where we have him. There are some teams and scouts we talk to that don't seem like they would want to take him until at least the third round. And then there are still some teams that are enamored with the pure stuff, the way the fastball plays, just the traits of his release, and his fastball makes it one of the more exciting pitches in this year's class, who would take him, I think, now, even still in the second round, just take a shot on that upside. If he goes out and really performs at a high level, I don't think like him being back in play the back of the first round is out of line. So I think for him, the fact that there is this foundation of elite peer stuff is a great starting point. He just needs to go out and perform. He needs to go out and miss bats. He needs to, for the teams that are maybe concerned that he's not going to profile as a starter, show enough conviction in his command, in the depth of his arsenal, to prove like, hey, you can run me out as a starter and you're going to be rewarded for it. So I find myself very high on Gabe Gackel and open to the idea that he could vault up boards. I know I'm probably one of the more optimistic in terms of our staff, and probably in line with the highest evaluators on him throughout the industry.
We got two more names that we're going to look at that I would say, like, theirs is more of like, okay, this is the chance to really shine. And we'll get into those right after this quick break. So, Carlos, when I'm looking at this and I'm looking at matchups and I'm looking at like must-see TV during the regionals, I will definitely be watching Liberty's, try to keep an eye on Liberty's first game, because I expect Ben Blair will start the opener. And if Ben Blair's on the mound, Liberty's got a chance to beat, you know, on a good day, most anybody. But why does he have more to gain from this than just your average run-of-the-mill college starting pitcher?
Yeah, I think Ben Blair is probably one of the most most prominent mid-major arms at the top of the board who has a chance to go in the first round who's not already there now. He probably is that guy, depending on how you're like classifying Notre Dame in their competition. I think it's a different level. But Ben Blair, I think this is just going to give him, like you said, it's going to give him a prominent stage to go perform and pitch on. He's pitched tremendously well this year. He's got a really unique angle to attack hitters. He has a loud two-pitch mix. He throws a ton of strikes. But I do think for Blair, when you're coming from a smaller school in Liberty, there are going to be some scouts who look at your performance with a more critical eye and say, hey, like, would you have done this if you were pitching in a power conference the entire year? If you're Ben Blair, you can go out and say, all right, I'll do it on the NCAA tournament stage. I don't know exactly who they're scheduled to play in the opener, or hopefully they can maybe have a sneaky run and get into some better. But certainly if they have like multiple weekends in the postseason and Blair gets an opportunity to do it multiple times, I think it's just going to give teams more confidence that the stuff plays. I think teams do a better job at like projecting individual pitch mixes at the next level in a pretty good way, but it's certainly not going to hurt a player like him to face really good competition. And he's maybe the, I would circle his name as a potential like first round kind of name as well. We have him just outside of that range right now.
To answer your question though, is they're facing BC, Boston College, in the Athens regional. And that's why I say, like, I expect that they'll use him in game one. That's a 3-2.
It would have been nice if he got a chance to face like one of the better offenses in the country.
Georgia's that was like, there, you know, but he won't face them.
When I was looking at that, I was like, yeah, I don't know exactly who he's going to pitch against. It tends to be just throw your best arms early. I think that's a smart strategy. And I don't know if you would want to throw your like ace against one of the few lineups who probably can do damage against any ace in the country this season, but they're going. But yeah, Ben Blair, definitely a name to watch.
Right. Again, like for them, like if you win that first game, like if you're Liberty, like if I'm Boston College, I'm kind of looking at that game and saying, oh no, because that's a guy who could absolutely beat us. And then if you're Liberty at that point, then you just kind of go, okay, let's figure out the rest of it. Hey, we're on a great run. But the other here is someone who's coming back. And I don't want to put it that you could expect too much out of NC State's Brian Marone, but we still, like, he has not fallen even after missing much of the season because of injury. But what could he do by coming back?
Yeah, so I think State has a couple of interesting pitchers who we really didn't penalize too much in this update, and actually got them a little bit higher because scouts basically told us, like, hey, you banged them too much for these injury questions. Ryan Marone is one who we're hoping to see pitch in the NCAA tournament. And then Jacob Duden is another who is not going to pitch anymore this year. But we got him back into the 100 after dropping him a decent amount because of that surgery, just because he was so dumb. I think he was like a no-doubt second rounder if he stays healthy. But Ryan Marone could also go in that range. And I think teams just have a lot of confidence in the pitchability that Ryan Marone brings to the table. So for him, it's not about proving himself. It's not about like showing better stuff down the stretch. I think it really is just about getting on the mound and showing that you're healthy, because he hasn't thrown a ton this year. He's missed some time with injury. And if he can show teams that he's healthy and pitching, I feel like once you're in this range with second round arms like Ethan Kleinschmidt, guys like Wes Mendez at Florida State, I don't know that there is a significant gap in how teams are viewing those college left-handed pitchers compared to a guy like Ryan Marone. And I also think, like, if you look at Ryan Marone's season, the 11.9% walk rate really jumps out to me for him. I think he is a far better strike thrower and command artist than that number represents and potentially him just battling some injuries. Maybe has a lot to do with that. But I think as we talk with scouts throughout the industry, there's just a lot of confidence in the command and control that he shows. And so just getting back on the mound, showing you're healthy, I think this is one of those. I hesitate to use high floor in the draft context or just prospect context in general, but he does get bucketed into this like relatively safe back of the rotation pitching profile.
Instead of saying high floor, let's kind of, to kind of try to explain that to people a little bit. The floor on all of these players is that that they don't ever come close to the major leagues, right? You're never talking about second round pick, and it's like, oh, his floor is right. That he could be a back of the rotation starter. No, that's an excellent outcome is right. That he becomes a back rotation starter. But
and I do think the way Ben talks about it, often you think of like high upside players as having lower floors, but like I think the higher your upside as a player, the higher your ceiling is. You're kind of dragging your floor with you, just because you have a lot of other ways to create value. Whereas with quote unquote like high floor, low ceiling players, like if you miss on that one trait that you're supposedly good at, like you said, your floor is you're not a major league player. And so yeah, I do hesitate throwing like floor and ceiling, especially floor around. But
what I would say though is what you're really saying though here is like when we talk about like if we're comparing say him to like a Gabe Gackle, right? Like Gabe Gackle has shown like the quality of stuff at his best is really good. Yeah. But Orion Marrone has kind of, even though he's missed much of this year, you just have this, again, we'll go back to track record. It's kind of this
3 years as a full-time starter in a really strong program and a strong conference.
Right. So it's kind of like, how much do you value the performance on the field versus the potential for what they could end up being? And to be honest, I feel like that's something in the draft nowadays that when you get into that third, fourth, fifth round,
yeah,
that's where you get a little bit of buckets of both here, because you will get college pitchers who it's like, this guy was a stud for 3 years, and you'll have other guys, it's like, we love his characteristics. Yes, he's been terrible in college, but we think we can develop him into a better pro. And you will see like examples of guys coming out of these rounds who had like 7 ERAs in college who end up being big league pitchers. So it's a little bit of both kind of working in these ranges.
I think I was just trying to pull it up because Matt Eddy had a really nice piece looking at the 2021 draft 5 years later today. And a lot of the biggest success stories when you get further down into the draft are college arms. Mike Vassell in the 8th round, Chase Silseth in the 11th round. I think there are probably some more higher that I skipped on because I know we were talking about it. But yeah, Brian Wu in the 6th round. Just look through these hits, and you could probably do it in most drafts, but I do think teams feel a confidence, whether that's like just feeling like this is an area of strength for most drafts at this like depth level of a draft, or like, hey, we can take these college players, these Ryan Marrone types who are really good pitchers, we're able to add stuff today in a way that we couldn't in the past. So well, I think that's a good example of that.
I'll just take Brian Wu as an example, right? So Brian Wu, in the year he was drafted, was a reliever with a 6.11 ERA, a 1.46 FIP. But again, to go back to your stat, a 13.5 strikeout per nine and a 2.6 walks per nine. So a good strikeout to walk ratio. As a reliever with 28 innings for Cal Poly, right? Like that's not, and by the way, if you say like, well, what was the year before? 17 innings the year before as a reliever and made some starts as a freshman and had an 8.75 ERA because 2020, he had the pandemic season in there in 2020, sophomore year. But my point of all of this is there are absolutely guys who are not performing, but have, like you said, they're like, okay, we can mold this raw clay into something we want.
Right.
And there's other players who it's like, okay, they've already shown it. And then again, there's like players like that where you're like, okay, we're comfortable taking this because of what he's already demonstrated, but let's see what we can add to it. And by the way, with all of these players, this is what's fun about this. We're talking about what they're going to be 3, 4, 5 years down the road, minimum. And a lot can change over that time, especially in a world now where, we're writing up prospects for starting pitching prospects, and it's like, he has 6 pitches, and college players rarely have 6 pitches. getting more, but not the same way that a lot of pro teams now are like, okay, so you're going to throw this slider to lefties. You're going to throw this slider to righties. You're going to throw this change up because it lets you do this. You're going to throw a four seamer, a two seamer and a cutter. Okay. Now we'll go out and attack. Okay. Again, so there's a lot of development ahead, but that is a look at the update for the Baseball America draft top 500. The BA 500 is live over at baseballamerica.com. And by the way, if you enjoy this and you also want to get ready for the regionals, or you are watching regionals as you listen to this, there's a lot more over at baseballamerica.com. We have previews of all 16 regionals. We also pulled out kind of like analytical darlings. Like if you want to know who are the hardest throwers, I think I counted 14 pitchers in the NCAA regionals who have touched 100 miles an hour this year, which...
It's the guns, JJ. It's the guns.
Yeah. No, it's not the guns. Everyone's throwing harder. But you got that. You've got like also if you want to see how the teams match up statistically, we also ranked all 64 teams, you know, as far as how they line up talent-wise. In the, you know, which by the way is not the same thing as our college top 25. Cause I feel like I've had to answer that a lot this week. You're like, why does this team drop? It's like, they haven't dropped. These are two different rankings. We love to rank a lot of things, but all that over at baseballamerica.com. For Carlos, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.